The problem over Sam's piano lessons began with his Christmas report card. His music teacher, Mrs. Crouch, wrote, "Sam has an unselfconscious sense of rhythm. It appears to come from inside him." "What does that mean?" said Dave. "He was sitting at the kitchen reading the report. It appears to come from inside him. Where else could it come from? Is Mrs. Crouch the one with a New Age pendant?" I think she means it's a gift," said Morley. She was pouring melted chocolate into Santa Claus molds. In February, at parent-teacher night, Mrs. Crouch sought them out. "Do you know he has perfect pitch?" she said. "The other day," said Mrs. Crouch, "in choir, he started to sing the descant quietly to himself. I just happened to catch it as I walked by. Most of the grade sixes can't do that," Morley nodded earnestly. But by the time they got home, her joy had been sideswiped by a spasm of guilt. Sam was 8 years old, and they hadn't done a thing to encourage this musical talent. What if Sam did have a gift? Morley felt like she'd been asleep at the switch, and she had done absolutely nothing for Sam. That night, Morley dreamed she was at a symphony concert. And in the middle of her dream, the conductor abruptly snapped his baton in two, and he hurled it on the stage, and the hall fell deadly quiet, and the conductor swiveled around, and he pointed at Morley. "Someone," he boomed, "has to leave the stage." Morley noticed for the first time that the musicians were playing vegetables. And then she saw her son, Sam, stand up in the middle of the leaf section. He was waving a huge eggplant over his head. "How do you expect me to play the eggplant," he said, "when I've only ever been given potatoes?" And then he pushed his way through the cucumbers with his head hanging down and left the stage. And the orchestra started to play again, and Morley noticed the entire root section was having dental work done as they played. When she woke up, Morley said, "I'm going to get Sam a piano teacher." He started lessons at the beginning of March with the only piano teacher in the neighborhood who had space to take him. His name was Ray Spinella, and he only had one arm. He wasn't the teacher Morley wanted, but she wanted to get Sam going. Everyone said the best teacher around was Brian Merriman. Morley had phoned Brian Merriman several times, but he didn't phone her back until the beginning of April. He said he'd take Sam, but not until September, and only if Sam could get his grade one. He suggested a month at a music camp. Camp Du Toit is good, he said. The problem was that Sam didn't want to go to Camp Du Toit to get his grade one piano. Sam wanted to go to the Lazy M Ranch and learn how to ride a horse. Dave said Sam should go to the horse camp. "Summers are for fun," he said. But Morley found herself uncharacteristically muddled. She was sure Sam would have fun at Camp Du Toit once he got there, but she didn't want to send him against his will. On Thursday, Dave's sister, Annie, phoned from the airport. She said, "I just got into town. I'm recording some sort of, I don't know, something tonight, and I'm flying back tomorrow early. Are you free for lunch?" Annie lives in Halifax. She plays in the string section of Symphony Nova Scotia. And Morley said, I'd love to have lunch." And they met in a large formal dining room on the seventh floor of a downtown department store. Music has always been a big part of Dave and Annie's life. It's no accident that Annie plays in the symphony and that Dave owns a record store and spent all those years working on the rock and roll circuit. Dave and Annie's father, Charlie, was a mining engineer who loved music. There was no money for music lessons when Charlie was a kid, but as an adult, he taught himself to play the piano, and then during the dark Cape Breton winter nights, the double bass. When Dave and Annie were growing up, they were constantly surrounded by music. Nearly every morning when it was time to get the kids out of bed, Charlie would sing them awake. He'd make up lyrics about the day ahead, the things they were going to do. He used songs that drove them crazy. What Charlie loved most were the nights when friends came over to the house and made music with him. Anybody was welcome as long as they could play something, which made for the weirdest combinations of instruments. A trio made up of recorder, double bass, and trumpet. Charlie was inevitably the worst player in these bands because although he loved music, he had absolutely no sense of rhythm and a very unusual sense of pitch. So the guy on the recorder and the guy on the trumpet would be playing away, and Charlie would lumber along on his bass about 20 yards behind them. Charlie was often still playing when the rest of the group got to the end of the piece. But they had a great time. When Charlie played his last note, his friend Fred, who regularly showed up to play the piano, would say, "Well, we won that one, Charlie." Dave and Annie both began piano lessons when they were six. They studied with the only piano teacher in Upper Contrition, Sister Emilien, at the convent of the Sisters of St. Soraya. Sister Emilien came from Point Vert on the south shore of the Bay de Chaleur. She was French, but she could speak English, and she was the nicest, kindest woman in the world. Annie adored her. One spring, she went on a school trip to Quebec City, and she bought Sister Emilien back a snow globe from St. Anne de Beaupré. It was a little plastic globe the size of a baseball with a miniature model of the shrine inside, and the globe was filled with water, and when you shook it, little white flecks floated in the water, and it made it look like it was snowing. "Oh, look," said Sister Emilien. "When I shake it, look how the angels fly around the shrine." She put it on a special shelf in her studio. Every lesson, Annie would head off determined to find out if Sister Emilien had any hair under her wimple or if, as Dave had earnestly told her, she was as bald as a bowling ball. Annie was forever touching Sister Emilien's long, graceful robes. There seemed to be so many mysterious layers. Sometimes she would reach out and touch one of the crosses that hung from around her neck. When she came home, she'd often borrow some of her mother's clothes, her skirts, and some of her old jewelry, and Margaret would sit patiently at the piano, and Annie would pretend she was a nun, and she'd give her mother a piano lesson. "Put your thumb on the C," she'd say. And Margaret would put her thumb on the D beside C and say, "This one?" Piano seemed to come naturally to Annie. She was playing Bach the first year she began her lessons, and maybe Sister Emilien was right. Maybe she could play better than any other six-year-old in the country. The summer she began piano, the summer she was six, Annie was chosen to play for Queen Elizabeth when she came to Halifax. Annie was sitting two rows behind the Queen, and she saw her yawn while the choir was singing "Farewell to Nova Scotia." And to this day, Annie can remember watching the Queen yawn and deciding that playing Bach was not a really good idea, thinking the Queen had probably already heard Bach. Annie decided it would be better if she made something up, and if someone hadn't come and dragged her off the stage, she would have sat there forever entertaining the Queen, completely confident that her tune was far superior to the piece by Bach that she'd been practicing. One day when Annie was seven, Charlie invited a fiddler to the house to play with him, and when Annie saw his violin, she fell in love with it. She had never been so close to a violin before. She loved the way it looked and the smell of the rosin and the rich colors of the wood, and she adored the sound. When they finished playing, she asked her father if she could touch the violin. The day Annie began her violin lessons was the most exciting day of her life. She came home from her first class, and she ripped open her violin case, and she made the whole family listen to what she could do. She could play all four open strings, E, A, D, and G. She had her mother call the notes to her, and she'd play them. She couldn't believe how easy it was. The next week, her teacher taught her to put her first finger down on the string, and she could play A and B, and this was a very big deal. She wanted to learn how to read notes. Just show me where they are," she said. And pretty soon she was able to play small pieces, and her teacher would play along. She was a violinist. It was brilliant. Eventually she got to a whole different level, and it became work, and she did what lots of kids do. She'd pretend to practice. She'd shut the door to her room and set up a book she was reading on her music stand. She read Anne of Green Gables this way. She'd play random notes and read her book. And when her mother called from the kitchen and said, "That doesn't sound like practicing to me," Annie would call back. She'd say, "I'm just sight reading." But she kept at it, and if you keep at anything long enough, things add up. She went to McGill University and studied music. And when she graduated, she got a job with the Montreal String Quartet. It was a wonderful honor for a young musician to be playing with all of these great musicians, all of them at least a decade older than her. But she felt incomplete. She wasn't having fun. Everybody was so intense and earnest. Annie thought when she got out of school, playing music would be fun. One day, a friend who knew the famous Israeli violinist, Avi Stovman, said, "He takes students, you know. If you want to write him, you can mention my name." So Annie wrote, and to her great shock, Avi Stovman called her back. He said, "Send me a tape." So she made a tape and she sent it to him, but he didn't respond. He said, "There's nothing I can do. I only take 7 students and already my class is full." Annie decided he had listened to the tape and it was dreadful and he was just being polite. But her friends didn't let her quit. They said, "Go to New York and phone him when you get there and play for him." She called him from outside of a bookstore on 52nd and 7th Avenue. He said, "Come on over. I'm leaving tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, but you can come tonight and play for me." And then Annie said, "That's okay. I don't think it's a very good time." And she said goodbye, and she hung up, and she decided that her music career was over. She didn't have what it took. Stovman was stunned. He couldn't figure her out. He knew that she had come to New York City to play for him, and he had offered his time. 3 months later, Annie told the whole story to the viola player in the Montreal String Quartet. And it turned out that this woman knew Stovman's assistant. They'd studied together. "You're crazy," she said. "I'm going to phone Ruth, and you're going to play for Stovman when he comes to Montreal." Annie went to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel and knocked on his door, nervous half to death. He was playing with the Montreal Symphony that night. It was 4 in the afternoon, and he was sitting on the couch watching MASH on television. Annie warmed up in the bathroom, and she thought she sounded okay, and then she came out, but when she put her bow on the strings, she couldn't hear anything. She stopped and said, "Maybe it's not such a good idea I come to New York City." But he said, "What? Do you think you won't learn anything? You think you have nothing to learn? Of course you have to come to New York. I'm just trying to think who you have to phone and how we're going to get you started." And that was that. He took her. Stovman had an apartment on Riverside Drive in the same building as Pinchas Zukerman and Yitzhak Perlman. Perlman lived on the top floor in the apartment where Babe Ruth used to live. Once while she was warming up, Annie played a reel and Stovman screamed at her, "Don't play like that in here," he said. The accompanist told Annie that he was harder on her than any of the other pupils, and that made her happy. She stayed 2 years, and when she left, she got a job with the Boston Symphony. She got married 6 months later. She thought she had everything she ever wanted. But the orchestra was constricting, the program was repetitive, and she couldn't believe the politics. She might as well have been an academic. After her 3rd year, Annie seemed stalled. Stovman stopped calling. She heard he was disappointed with her. She wasn't progressing fast enough through the orchestra. And then when she got divorced, she decided she'd had enough. She quit the orchestra and she moved back to Nova Scotia. Stovman was furious. He wrote her a blistering 3-page letter. "What are you trying to do to me?" he said. To him, thought Annie. What am I trying to do to him? Oddly, the letter made her feel better about her decision. She took a contract with Symphony Nova Scotia, but she also joined a Celtic group. Suddenly, music was fun again. Now, Morley knew much of this, but she hadn't heard all of it before, not all at once. They were eating dessert when Morley told Annie about Sam's piano lessons and what his teacher, Mrs. Crouch, had said about him and her plan to send him to music camp so he could study with Brian Merriman. Annie said, "Brian Merriman is a prissy snob. I thought Sam already had a music teacher. You said he's having fun with this guy." So on Thursday, when Morley took Sam to his piano lesson, she asked if she could stay and watch. Ray Spinella, the one-armed teacher, looked surprised but delighted. You could sit over there," he said. And Morley did her best to disappear, not get in the way. And she watched at the end of the lesson, Ray took a trumpet off the top of the piano and he played along. He wasn't following a method. He wasn't teaching the grade one syllabus. He was teaching Sam something much more important. On the way home, Morley said, "When you're at camp, do you think they'll give you your own horse, or do you have to share it?" Sam said, I think you have to share, but I'm going to save up and buy my own horse. I'm going to call him Bach. Ray's going to teach me some of the cowboy songs that Bach wrote. Can I do piano next year? We'll see, said Morley. Sam had his face pressed to the window of the car. He was whistling the tune that he had just made up, the tune he and Ray had been playing together.